I love the moon. Everyone knows that, but love it a little bit more now.
We actually made a really cool discovery.
So if we're looking for extraterrestrial life, what better place to start than a giant ocean?
And it's dubbed a hot ice world.
Hello, welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society. With me, science journalist Izzy Clark and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
And thank you to the UK Space Agency for sponsoring this episode. But all right, time to wrap up warm, Izzy, because this month we're exploring the icy worlds in our solar system. And to help us, we'll be joined by Caroline Harper, head of space science at the UK Space Agency. We'll be chatting to her about the new mission heading to explore Jupiter's icy moons.
And we'll hear from Professor Michelle Doherty from Imperial College London, who sent Cassini to investigate Saturn's moon Enceladus. And last, but by no means least, Dr. Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, is here too. So, Robert, what do we classify as an icy world? Are we talking about worlds that permanently look like a winter here on Earth?
Well, I don't think you have to necessarily think about it as just being like a cold Earth, although that would obviously be a classic example of an icy world. And there is this idea that 600 million years and more ago, the Earth was like that. There was this snowball Earth idea when there were glaciers all over the planet. And I think if you were an astronomer looking at it from a distant star, you would definitely see it as an icy world. But in our own solar system, we can be talking about things like some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, like Europa with a dirty, great, thick 20-kilometer ice crust above an ocean, Enceladus around Saturn, which shoots geysers of water into space, but it again has got this big, thick ice crust. And we also talk about Uranus and Neptune as ice giants too. So you don't, although it is a category, you can think about this sort of, you know, somehow Narnia in the depths of winter. You can also think about just cold planets too, places that are so far from the sun that at least the top of their atmospheres is really very cold indeed.
I mean, that's a book I want to read, Narnia in Space. Yes, please.
We need to pitch this, don't we?
We'll add it to our list of sci-fi. Yeah. Cheers, Robert. We'll catch up with you later in the episode.
Glaciers, ice mountains, and vast canyons mold these worlds of ice. But how much do we know about them, and what missions can tell us more? I spoke with Professor Michelle Doherty from Imperial College London, who started by explaining how common these icy worlds are.
They're actually more common than we originally thought. And we see them in a number of the moons around the outer planets in our solar system. So around Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune as well.
What did these worlds look like? What makes these worlds icy? Talk me through it.
Okay, so the way that I think about icy worlds is it's any planetary body in our solar system and beyond the solar system where you don't have liquid on the surface, but you have an ice form of that liquid instead. You've got lots of topography. So you've got mountains, you've got valleys, you've got old riverbeds. On some of the bodies, you might have bits of ice that move around. One of the views that I really like is of Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. When we were able to fly, if you fly over the Greenland ice shelf, you see bits of ice breaking off from the edge of the ice shelf. And that's what the surface of Europa looks like in parts as well.
Yeah, it might be a simple question, but why are they icy? Is it purely because they are just further away from the sun and they're at these outer planets?
That is our understanding of them, yeah. I mean, from my perspective, and when you said it might be a simple question, it's always a simple question, so they're difficult ones to answer. From my perspective, I think the biggest discovery that we have made in planetary science in the last 30 years or so is the fact that, you know, planetary scientists search for liquid water, because if you think of liquid water, you think of life. And the focus had really been on planets close to the sun, because if you're looking for liquid, you need to be close to the heat source, which is the sun. But what we found with various planetary missions like the Galileo spacecraft at Jupiter and more recently the Cassini spacecraft at Saturn, is that you can find liquid water underneath the surface of the icy bodies. And so they're icy because they're far away from the sun, but there is an internal heat source that is making the ice liquid underneath the surface. And so there's now been a real change as far as focus for search for habitability. You don't have to be close to the sun. We can be searching much further away from the sun.
But let's focus on Saturn's icy moons.
Okay.
This is something you've worked on. So what are they? What do they look like?
There are lots of icy moons of Saturn. I think at the last count, there are about 65 or something. But the ones of interest that Cassini focused on were Enceladus, which I'm going to talk a bit about in detail, Titan, the largest moon of Saturn. And Titan is the one where the European Space Agency Huygens probe traveled down through the atmosphere and landed on the surface. There are a whole range of moons, most of which have got icy surfaces. But I think for me, my favorite is Enceladus. And the reason for that is with the Cassini spacecraft and the magnetometer instrument that I was responsible for on the Cassini spacecraft, we actually made a really cool discovery. And that was the fact that there's outgassing of water vapor from the south pole of Enceladus. It looks a bit like a cometary plume of water vapor.
What was it looking for? What were you aiming to find?
I was really fortunate. I became involved just after launch. And what this instrument does is it measures the magnetic field in the environment of the spacecraft. And you might be thinking to yourself, how on earth can a magnetometer discover there's water vapor leaking out from the moon? The way that we did that is what we found is as we flew close to Enceladus, we found that the magnetic field of Saturn, which should have not noticed Enceladus was there, seemed to be draped around Enceladus. Something was stopping it from penetrating down onto the surface. And in addition to that, we saw a lot of wave activity in the data. And that wave activity was linked to a large increase in water group ions. And so this was telling us effectively that Enceladus was acting as an obstacle to the flow of plasma and the magnetic field coming from Saturn. And it was when we got really close, after we persuaded the project to take us really close, that we saw that there was this outgassing of water vapor coming from the South Pole. So from my perspective, and I'm not biased at all, a magnetometer instrument is the most important instrument on any planetary mission.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't argue that one.
I didn't think you would. Thank you.
So what did that feel like? You know, how... Break the mission down for me.
You need a lot of patience to be involved in outer planetary missions. So we were launched in October 1997. Took us 6.5 years to get to Saturn, or almost 7 years. So we arrived there in July 2004. And it had always been planned that in the first 6 months of 2005, we were going to fly past Enceladus on three separate occasions, just to see what it is that we could find. And on the first two flybys, which were quite distant flybys, we saw these strange signatures in the magnetic field. I was a little worried because I hoped we had calibrated our data properly. We talked in the team about what it is that we thought we might be seeing. And one way that we could describe the observations was if Enceladus had an atmosphere, a bit like the atmosphere on the Earth. The upper regions of the atmosphere become ionized by solar radiation, and that stops the magnetic field of the solar wind penetrating through. So what we did is we put a schematic together to show what we thought was going on. And in fact, there was a science meeting being held at the Jet Propulsion Lab about a month after the second flyby. And I went out to JPL, and I was going to give a presentation to the team there and try and persuade the project to change the third flyby altitude from 1,000 kilometers to about 170 kilometers above the surface.
Oh, so really close.
Really close. And I was really nervous about doing this because, you know, we'd spent the 6.5 years it took us to get to Saturn planning every second of the observations we were going to make. So if we changed the trajectory of the spacecraft, that meant some of the instruments wouldn't be taking the data they were hoping to get. I was jet-lagged to hell, decided I needed a cup of coffee. So I went and stood in the line at Starbucks. And the man standing in the line in front of me turned around to me and said, "Michelle, what are you doing here?" And it turned out it was Jerry Jones, who was responsible for the safety of the spacecraft. And I told him why I was there. And he rubbed his hands together in glee and he smiled and he said, "I've always wanted to go closer to a planetary body than anyone else." So I knew I had one vote in my back pocket.
That's amazing.
Not everyone thought it was a good idea to do, but the majority of the team said, "Yes, let's go ahead and do it." And so the project changed the flyby altitude, so it really essentially skimmed below the South Pole. And the reason it went below the South Pole was not because we thought anything was happening there, but because that used the least amount of extra fuel to do that. But it was great that it went below the South Pole, because that's where the cracks are. And that's when we realized it wasn't an atmosphere covering the entire surface, but there was essentially this outgassing of water vapor at the South Pole. And I must confess, for the couple of nights before that flyby, I didn't sleep very well, because if we had found nothing, no one would ever have believed anything I said again.
Yeah, but then you find these amazing jets of vapor coming out from these cracks. So what's the next steps in terms of exploring icy worlds? Are there plans to explore Saturn's moons further?
Yes, there are. In fact, there is a NASA mission called Dragonfly, which is going to focus on Titan, which is the large moon at Saturn. We've got liquid ethane and liquid methane on the surface, but we've got liquid water underneath the surface. But I think for me, the next steps as far as icy worlds are concerned, and I know you're going to talk about this more in the second part of the program, is JUICE, the European Space Agency mission to Jupiter and its moons. For me, it's getting an understanding of the internal structure of these moons, whether there's organic material there, and what we might want to do when we go back in the future, where it is we want to focus on.
That was Michelle Doherty from Imperial College London. So, Becky, what are some of the coldest temperatures we see across our solar system?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that can take maybe coldest temperature. If you're talking first about the coldest planet, right, there's a bit of contention here, it turns out, right? You'd think that the coldest planet would be Neptune, right, by virtue of it being furthest from the sun. But Neptune only has the coldest average temperature, like overall, at minus 200 Celsius. Little bit tricky, right. I'm sure you agree. But in terms of the coldest single temperature, Uranus actually takes that crown there with a low of like minus 224 Celsius. So just a couple of degrees lower, right, than Neptune, just sort of pips it to the post. Then you've obviously got the coldest recorded temperature on a dwarf planet. And I know some people would always want me to think about dwarf planets because of Pluto, but it's not Pluto. Pluto doesn't take the coldest dwarf planet crown. It's actually... I'm going to pause before I say this because I always say it wrong. Makemake.
Right.
Which I honestly thought was pronounced make-make for an embarrassingly long amount of time until I was like 30 years old and 7 years as a professional astronomer. Makemake. Makemake is minus 243 Celsius.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's getting really cold, right? But the lowest temperature ever recorded anywhere in the solar system is actually a little bit closer to home. It's our very own moon. In 2009, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is a satellite that orbits the moon, measured the temperature inside a crater, the Hermite Crater, which is right on the north pole of the moon. So it doesn't get a lot of sun up there. It gets very, very cold, minus 248 degrees Celsius.
Oh my God.
Which is only, it's only 30 degrees above absolute zero, right? And a good, you know, what was Neptune before? Minus 200. So it's 50 degrees cooler than Neptune's average temperature, right? So, I mean, you're not looking at the moon the same, will you?
No, but I'm wondering, like, so why is it that specific crater is colder than, you know, objects way further out in our solar system?
Yeah, it's just about energy that reaches that crater, right? So it's very shadowed against the sun. So there will be literally parts of it that never seen sunlight because they're so shadowed of where it is and also the walls of the crater. But if you think about Uranus and Neptune as well, you can't really talk about surface temperature necessarily. And yes, the outer edges will be very cold. But as you get into the interior of the planets, they get denser and denser. And obviously things start to heat up as well. So that's the thing, is that the moon obviously doesn't have any interior heating. It's not volcanic in any way. And then you've got this region that's just shaded from any sunlight. And so it's incredibly, incredibly cold.
I mean, I love the moon. Everyone knows that, but love it a little bit more now. And there is a question here about the potential for habitability. So what is it about these icy worlds that make them good candidates to explore that?
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, some of what we think are the most habitable places in the solar system are the icy worlds, like Titan, Europa, Enceladus, etc. And that's because even though they have these very icy crusts on the surface that are very thick, they have these liquid oceans underneath their crust. So one study actually estimated that the total amount of water on these icy worlds is around about 30 to 40 times what we have on Earth. So in total on all of them. And we know life on Earth needs water to thrive, right? And that it began also in our oceans. So finding and having water oceans elsewhere, even on these icy worlds, raises the question of whether there's life in those oceans too, especially if there's volcanic activity on the inside as well that could provide a heat source. Perhaps you might get like thermophilic bacteria that can survive these extreme conditions as well. And of course, we've seen evidence of volcanic activity on Enceladus, right? You know, one of Saturn's moons, for example. We have these big geysers from its south pole. Cassini flew through them and found they contain minerals and molecules that indicate volcanic activity as well. So people are very hopeful about Enceladus. I personally think it's my favorite moon in the solar system, not just because it's a moon of Saturn, but also because of this like extremely cool reason that there could be life there. And so there's really big pushes for missions to explore these worlds further to try and answer that question of, are we alone in the universe?
So how do we better understand icy moons? We send a spacecraft, of course. In May 2022, JUICE, aka the Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer, will begin a 7.6-year cruise to Jupiter to spend 3.5 years in the Jovian system. I spoke with Caroline Harper, Head of Space Science at the UK Space Agency, about this mission.
Okay, well, JUICE is a European Space Agency mission to study Jupiter and three of its largest moons, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto. And it's due to launch next year from the European Spaceport in French Guiana. It's going to be carrying a suite of science instruments designed and built by teams of researchers from the UK and across Europe. So we're very excited to see what we can find out about Jupiter and its moons in the very near future.
Yeah, so what do we actually know so far about Ganymede, Callisto and Europa?
Well, we know from previous observations, they're all very cold, around about minus 140 degrees C, with very thin atmospheres and with thick icy crusts. And we're not absolutely sure, but we believe that under the surface, they could be hiding enormous oceans of liquid water, thousands of kilometres across and much deeper than the oceans on Earth. More water, in fact, than all the surface water here on Earth. We know there are icy moons around Saturn. Enceladus is one that has a subsurface ocean. There's a lot of research being done on that at the moment. Well, now it's Jupiter's turn. So this makes these icy moons some of the most exciting objects to study in the solar system, really. Liquid water is essential for all life here on Earth. So if we're looking for extraterrestrial life, or at least the conditions to support life, what better place to start than a giant ocean? And JUICE is going to give us the data we need to confirm whether the ocean actually exists.
Yeah, so what is that data? You know, what is it hoping to find? What's it looking out for?
Yes, well, it's going to orbit Jupiter, and there'll be lots of work looking at the atmosphere and the clouds and the weather systems of Jupiter. And then it will fly by two of the moons, Europa and Callisto, and then finally settle into orbit around the third one, Ganymede, which is a particular focus for this mission. The UK is involved in instrument development for JUICE, and one of the instruments is the magnetometer, which is being led by Michelle and a team at Imperial College. We will be using that magnetometer to do a number of things, but we'll be focusing particularly on Ganymede, because it's pretty special. It's the biggest moon in the solar system, bigger than Mercury, much bigger than our moon. And it's the only one we know with a strong magnetosphere, which is this sort of shield around it to trap and deflect cosmic radiation and particles from the sun, just like our magnetosphere here on Earth. So we're very interested to understand more about that. And we'll be using the magnetometer to measure the magnetic field and to add to our knowledge. It will help us to understand more about the magnetic field here on Earth as well. So we'll be doing all of that. There's lots more instruments, 10 instruments altogether on JUICE. There's radar to penetrate the surface. There's a laser altimeter that's going to measure the sort of tidal stretching and relaxing of the moons that Jupiter's gravitational pull causes. And this is interesting because this stretching and squeezing can cause tectonic activity. And that generates heat, much as if you took a ball of clay and you kneaded it, you'd find it heated up. And so where there's heat energy, that might provide the energy required for life.
We said it's a long trip. What are the challenges of sending a mission towards Jupiter?
Well, that's a very good question. It is very challenging. The long distance means you have to have a huge solar array to power the spacecraft for all that long time cruising towards Jupiter and to keep the instruments active when we get there. So that solar array, I think it's about 85 square meters, will have to be folded up inside the rocket launcher, and then it will have to be deployed in space. So that's a challenge. It's going to have to be really autonomous when it gets there. It's going to take a very long time for command signals from the ground to reach the spacecraft, and some of the time it's going to be out of communication. So it's really going to have to look after itself a lot of the time. It's going to have to be very reliable. It's going to have to cope with a lot of radiation around Jupiter. All of the instruments on board have had to be shielded or radiation hardened so that they can cope with that environment. There's been a lot of testing on the ground to make sure that's going to work. And actually, before you can launch anything into space, you have to test to make sure it can withstand the shock of launch. And then it's not just the radiation in space, it's the temperature extremes. And of course, it's a vacuum. So there's been a lot of testing on various models of JUICE leading up to the eventual flight model that will be launched and will go and take the instruments to do their stuff. So a lot of challenges.
Yeah. And so what can a mission like this tell us about our solar system? You know, if we're exploring these three moons, these icy worlds, what else can that reveal?
It's a sort of a mini model of the solar system as a whole. We call them moons because they're orbiting a planet, but they are bigger than Mercury, much, much bigger than our moon. So they sort of mimic what's going on in the solar system as a whole. So the more we can understand about the Jupiter system, the more we'll understand about our solar system as well. What can it tell us looking at Jupiter and its moons and the way they tug on each other because of their gravity? That's going to show us how the sun and planets interact in that way. We can use the fact that Ganymede's magnetosphere interacts with Jupiter's to know a little bit more about how the Earth and the sun interact. So it's a sort of a mini model of the solar system, and we can do an awful lot of physics that will help us to understand more about the solar system as a whole.
And, you know, we've said this is a challenging mission in itself, but what do you think the future holds for exploring other icy worlds further, or even these same ones? What's going to happen in the future?
Well, there's an awful lot of interest. As I say, these icy moons are one of the most exciting things we can possibly look at in the solar system and beyond because of the potential habitability. And certainly the James Webb Space Telescope, which is NASA's next big observatory following in the footsteps of Hubble, that's going to be launched this December.
Yes, we're very excited for it on the Supermassive podcast.
I am very excited. We've done a lot of work. The UK has led on one of the instruments on James Webb, so I've been very closely connected with it, and I'm really looking forward to it launching. One of the things that Webb will do is observe Europa, and another icy moon, this time of Saturn, Enceladus, because both of them, we think, are producing plumes of possibly water vapor that are shooting up through cracks in the ice hundreds of kilometers up. And in 2008, the Cassini mission was able to fly through the plumes on Enceladus and analyze them. And we'd like very much to get more information about that and to do the same thing on Europa. And then after that, NASA plans to launch Europa Clipper in the next few years. And this will go back to Europa again and study it much as JUICE is going to look at Ganymede, and for very similar reasons. And then finally, in the future, there might be a joint ESA-NASA mission to the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, and their icy moons. Because the more we learn, the more questions we're going to have. And really, this is just a very exciting time to be someone who's studying and exploring icy moons.
This is the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and science journalist extraordinaire Izzy Clark.
That's me. This month we're exploring the coolest worlds in our solar system, and the questions from listeners have been rolling in, so Becky, Robert, get ready.
I'm limbering up.
Let's start with this question from NZC Meow. I think I've got that name right. Apologies if that's not correct. They ask, can there be an icy world close to a star? Venus is hotter than Mercury, even though it's further from the sun. So could a planet be colder than its neighbour, but closer to their star?
Yeah, you can get planets hotter at greater distances because of atmosphere. And that's what happens in the case of Venus and Mercury. Venus is hotter because it has this thick carbon dioxide atmosphere that traps energy in this runaway greenhouse effect, you know, heating it more than Mercury, where the surface on Mercury is just fried by the sun, right? And it reflects a lot of sun's energy back out into space. So it doesn't really heat up the same as Venus does and just store heat in that way. So that's what's responsible for Venus and Mercury giving you different hotter stars at different distances. But in terms of getting an icy world close to a star, theoretically, yes, you can, right? You could have an icy world close to a star, perhaps if it's not as hot as the sun, maybe like a brown or a red dwarf that's, you know, it's still like 3000 Kelvin, but it's not the 5000 odd Kelvin of the sun, right? It's an astronomer's cool. And in fact, there is actually a planet called Gliese 436b. And it's orbiting a red dwarf about 22 times closer than Mercury. And it's about the same size as Neptune. And it's dubbed a hot ice world.
Okay.
Which is really weird, right? Yeah, hot ice. It sounds so strange. So we think it has this sort of like steamy water, you know, like water vapor and hydrogen atmosphere surrounding it because, you know, the planet is very big. It can hold on to that, but it's just very close to its star. So close to the surface, it would be, you know, very steamy almost. But the thing is, the pressure is then you get lower in the atmosphere would mean that, you know, if there is a lot of water there, it will turn to ice, even if it's really hot because it's really close to the star. So whether water is a liquid or a solid or a gas, it doesn't just depend on temperature, right? It depends on pressure as well. So think about like when you go up in altitude, right? Say you're going on a holiday, you're going to the mountains, maybe you're going skiing, right? Your kettle for your tea boils quicker at higher altitudes because the pressure is lower, right? It doesn't boil at 100 degrees C. It boils slightly less the temperature, like, you know, like 96, something like that, depending on how high up you are. So it's sort of like the reverse of that that's happening in this atmosphere, right? Is that even though it's really hot, the pressure is so high that you'll still get ice rather than liquid water or a gas. And so that's how you can get a hot ice world really close to a star.
I love that. Thank you so much for answering that one. Robert, we've got this one from Anita Ragg, who wants to know, we don't know much about icy worlds like Neptune and Uranus, but what information do you think the James Webb Space Telescope could give us about these planets?
Well, I'm going to struggle to answer Becky's baked Alaska answer to that planet. But yeah, the Webb Telescope, James Webb Telescope about to launch, you know, very, very soon, hopefully by the end of this year, it'll be up and running and we'll start to answer these questions. And the big difference is that the James Webb Telescope will have a much bigger mirror than Hubble, about 6.5 meters across if it unfolds successfully. So to deliver sharper images to begin with, it's also operating in mid-infrared. So it's looking at the universe in a different way. And it'll also be doing things like spectroscopy, so splitting the light from objects to understand what they're made of. And those things together will help us study Uranus and Neptune. Now, we're not going to see any probes there for decades. They're just so far away. It's so expensive. I think one will arrive by the time I'm 80. So I'm not holding my breath to see these results in great detail, or at least probably not while I'm still working anyway. But with that bigger telescope in orbit, we can look at them. It's part of the program. We can see the weather patterns because now there are no space missions. That's what we do. You know, we look at these distant worlds with telescopes like Hubble and then the James Webb Telescope. We can see the weather changing, see if there's anything like any more dark spots that were around the famous great dark spot that Voyager saw back in 1989. And we can analyze the composition of the atmospheres because that's what a spectroscope can do. It can look for the chemicals in there, and we can understand things like the mysteries of these planets. Uranus has winds, I think, 560 miles an hour, and Neptune has some extraordinarily fast winds. I think 1,500 miles an hour is the record they clocked there. It's a very, very, very windy place. So those kind of things are the sort of things that the Webb Telescope will answer. And the other one of the other odd things is that Uranus and Neptune, although they're quite similar, there are some distinct differences. And one really weird thing is that Neptune gives off more heat than it receives from the sun, but Uranus doesn't. So although Neptune is much further from the sun, the top of the atmosphere is a similar temperature to Uranus. That's really not well understood why that's happening. There are really intriguing things going on as well in some of the models. I mean, some researchers have suggested that there might be diamonds sinking down through the deeper bit of the atmosphere, for example, which I think is another science fiction premise, actually, diamond miners on Uranus.
Love that. Yes, please.
We can definitely go for that one, can't we? So there are lots of mysteries in these two planets, and the James Webb Telescope is certainly going to be a big part of understanding more. It's actually a UK scientist, Lee Fletcher in Leicester, who's leading this work.
Yeah, and sticking with these two outer planets, Becky, Timo asks, why haven't we had a mission to Neptune and Uranus since Voyagers flew by them? I think everyone wants to know the answer to that. And how are the conditions at the cores of those two outermost planets, and what are they made of?
Well, it's not for lack of trying, Timo, let me tell you, in terms of missions to Neptune and Uranus. The people who study Neptune and Uranus are desperate, for want of a better word, right? We know so little about them except for that brief glimpse that Voyager gave us. And like most pursuits of science, it left us with more questions than answers. And hopefully the James Webb will go some way to answering a couple of those, but will probably also give us more questions as well. Especially because, I mean, Uranus spins on its side. It's the weirdest planet in our solar system, right? It's more than 90 degrees different in terms of its axis compared to how the sun spins. So its magnetic field and aurora and incredibly weird. Those are things that we already don't understand very well of other planets either. So, you know, getting at Neptune and Uranus would be a dream, I think, for a lot of people. The problem is their distance. And remember, when Voyager was launched, it was when the outer planets of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they were all not aligned, but they were roughly in a line, so that they were at least in the same direction going into space, which is not always true for those planets that are very, very far away. So we'd have to send separate missions to Neptune and Uranus if we were going to do it now. They're in the works for maybe 2030, but you know, there's only so much money we can spend on these kind of missions, and they get a lot of competition. Missions exploring mirror planets like Mars, as we've seen a lot of in recent years, and obviously Venus is getting up there now after that phosphine discovery too last year, and obviously these potentially habitable icy worlds as well of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are sort of winning out against a Uranus and Neptune mission at the minute, and they get chosen for funding instead. So that's mainly the reason. As for the cores, Timo, of Uranus and Neptune, we think they're very similar to our own, to be honest, of Earth. They're mostly iron and a bit of rock, right? We think that all bodies in the solar system formed in this hierarchical way of clumping together bits of rock, which as they started to then get heavier, they would attract the much lighter gases around them, and that would build up the gas giants. Of course, sending a mission there would help us know a lot more. So, I mean, if any of the panels of NASA and ESA are listening right now, know that my vote is for a Uranus and Neptune.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. Well, thank you to everyone that sent in questions. And if you want to send in one of your own for a future episode, then email podcast@ras.ac.uk or tweet @RoyalAstroSoc. And I just want to note that if these past two episodes have piqued your interest, then there's a new book by Natalie Starkey called Fire and Ice, The Volcanoes of the Solar System. So pretty perfect for what we've been talking about recently. But we will bring back Book Club next month. So ready your science books for that one.
I have to make a quick plug for one I was sent as well, which is a Voyager, a photo album, mainly because it's been in my study here at home for a while. But it's fun. You know, the Voyager missions were such a long time ago, but the images are still fantastic. And they are the only images we have of Uranus and Neptune, only close-up ones. So it's just called Voyager, Photographs from Humanity's Greatest Journey. And I think it's great.
It's huge. Like, listeners can't obviously see this, but it's like this massive white book with a big gold print on the front that's like, Voyager. Like, yes, okay. I get it. I want that.
Exactly.
So, Robert, what can we see in the night sky this month?
Well, it's really appropriate that we've been talking about ice giants, Uranus and Neptune, and icy moons, because all of them are actually quite well placed in the sky from the UK at the moment. So we've still got Jupiter and Saturn down in the southern sky. They're getting a little easier to see in terms of, you know, being an antisocial time of night. They're actually there in the early evening sky now as well. They're very obvious, very bright, just on the southern horizon. And you get sort of Saturn first, then Jupiter further to the left. And those planets, obviously, you can actually see Europa fairly easily with a pair of binoculars orbiting around Jupiter, and Enceladus with a reasonable telescope going around Saturn. So if you want to see these icy moons, at least as glimpse of light, you can do that. And further on in the sky, a bit later in the night, you've got Uranus and Neptune too. And Neptune is in Aquarius, and that means it's going to be rising slightly, you know, mid-evening onwards. Best place around midnight and 1 a.m. but still on summertime, and Uranus a bit after that. So it's a really good time to see all these worlds we've been describing. Now, I should stress that Neptune and Uranus, they look really tiny. If you've got a pair of binoculars, you need a pair of binoculars to see them at all. and you'll probably just see them as a star-like point. And if you really want to be a sort of classical astronomer, what you can do is look at the part of the sky where they are. There are various finder charts online. Look at them one night and then look at them the next and plot them moving across compared with the other stars. That's quite a nice way to find them too. I should also say we're actually running a live event completely coincidentally, which is called something like Finding Out More About Uranus. And that'll be run from the 8th to the 10th of October. The RAS is doing that. We'll have details on our website and we'll plug it on Twitter and so on. And that will be where we're connecting to UK astronomers, some that will be in the UK and some will be running the telescopes on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, looking at Uranus and nice. Hopefully trying to answer some of the questions we've been talking about.
I'll probably join that one rather than try and set up my own, like, oh god, it's not working again.
we need telescope surgery for you, Izzy. Telescope surgery
and to move out of London.
I know, tell me about it. But all I want to say as well is that they are going to try and do things like see if they can detect the aurora on Uranus. They're not promising because it's difficult, but they're going to give that a shot. And then obviously beyond that, you know, it's the autumn sky, you can see things like the Andromeda galaxy, the furthest object visible to the unaided eye, get a nice finder chart near the square of Pegasus in the eastern sky as the night goes on. So there's a lot going on, and go out and enjoy it.
And can we shout out to Rohi in India, who sent us a brilliant photo of Venus and the crescent moon last month. And so we love to see your astronomy photos, so do keep them coming. And Becky, you're hoping to make some observations this week. Is that happening? What can you tell us?
So I have time on the Isaac Newton telescope in La Palma from Wednesday to Sunday this week. But those of you who have been watching the news will have noticed that La Palma is currently under a state of emergency after the volcano there erupted for the first time in 50 years. Our observations are a little bit up in the air at the moment, mainly because obviously the flights, everyone will know, volcanic ash and flights don't pair well together. So the airport on the island has been closed. But there is a big impact for volcanic ash on observing as well that people might not know about. So volcanic ash is fine particles of rock. It's not soft and fluffy ash like you would get from, say, you know, a fire. You know, maybe people are lighting fires as we get into autumn now. It's hard and it's abrasive. So telescope domes and telescope drivers for pointing, they're all moving parts, right? It's a lot of moving parts. If you get ash in there, it can do a lot of damage. Ash is also bad for electronics as well. It can block vents and jam cooling fans, so the equipment overheats and it can short circuit things as well because it's rock, so it contains a bit of metal. Even keyboards on computers are at risk, right? So opening the dome at all is basically a no-go when there is any risk of volcanic ash in the air. The obvious other thing as well is that what really scuppers astronomical observations, even if you probably could open the telescopes because there was nothing low down, if there's ash high up in the atmosphere, there's honestly no point opening the dome. Observatories are built, you know, away from light pollution, but also high up because then the air is less humid. It's thinner. There's less atmospheric disturbance and turbulence, right, that's going to disturb the light on its way through the atmosphere to the telescope, right? We all talk about twinkle, twinkle, little star when we're kids. That's an astronomer's worst nightmare. You want no twinkle at all, right? If it's twinkling, your pictures are going to be so blurry, and tiny ash particles only increase the twinkle.
She's destroying the romance of the night sky in a single sentence. Yeah.
I do. Not only are we ruining everyone's favourite science fiction films, we've moved on to nursery rhymes. My goodness.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how annoying you are.
they might be persuaded to sing that. Yeah.
Oh, well, fingers crossed. Third time lucky.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, I think that is it for this month. Next month, we're finally getting to it. JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope.
I can't wait. Yeah, I mean, it was supposed to be October launch, right? It's been pushed back to December, but it's an official launch date. An official launch date has been set. Previously, it was sort of a targeted launch date, but now it's in the diary. It's not in pencil. It's been written in pen, and we're all very excited.
I mean, I made a documentary about the James Webb Space Telescope in 2018 for Five Live.
Yeah, I remember going to a conference and being told, you know, get thinking now what you want to propose for time on the James Webb Space Telescope, because, you know, early proposals have got to be in by 2017. Anyway, thank you again to the UK Space Agency for sponsoring this episode of the Supermassive Podcast. Please don't forget to follow and subscribe. And even better, if you want to leave a review and tell the world why you love the show, then please do. That really helps us out. Until next time, though, happy stargazing.